This is Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We have some more sad news involving the opioid epidemic in Indiana, and in particular here in Northwest Indiana. The LaPorte County Drug Task Force has put out an update on the community alert and other information that they had late last week. A 58-year-old woman who suffered an overdose at a residence on U.S. 6 in LaPorte County died as a result of the overdose. And also, too, a death of a man on Montrose Street in LaPorte. And after the reports came in, the emergency responders went to the 900 block of Jackson Street in LaPorte because of an overdose there. But luckily, that female victim was revived by the officers at the scene with Narcan and then transported to LaPorte Hospital. In just over 12 hours into the weekend, the LaPorte County Drug Task Force, along with police officers from the LaPorte City Police and the LaPorte County Sheriff's Department, had begun investigations into these suspected heroin overdose cases, with the two deaths to note. LaPorte County Sheriff John Boyd said they've seen spikes in overdose cases across the state and the rest of the country, and he says it appears as we're suffering the same fate as many other communities. And Sheriff Boyd encouraged all residents in LaPorte County who knows of a person struggling with a heroin addiction to watch over them closely, seek whatever assistance is available, and to monitor every minute of the day for these people. Northwest Indiana and the rest of the Hoosier State dealing with this devastating effects of opioid addiction. We got some insight today into the opioid addiction crisis and how it got started, oftentimes with alcohol addiction. Dr. Chris Johnson is the National Medical Director for Pinnacle Treatment Centers across the Midwest and in other states to the East Coast, as well as the Recovery Works facilities, which includes the one residential facility here in Merrillville. He is an expert dealing with addiction and some of the problems that people have as a result of it. And we have him here today to talk about the very serious nature of the opioid addiction problem here in Indiana and in our region in particular. Dr. Johnson, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, I'm glad to be a part of your show.
Tell us about your experiences, your education and expertise in addiction problems. And in particular, why it seems we'd be running into these problems and we have such an epidemic proportions here in Indiana these days.
Yeah, so let me talk a little bit about the Midwest problem. And my understanding is, through the 80s and 90s, there was a growing issue with doctors overprescribing opioid medications, which kind of primed the whole environment for the transition to the heroin problem. When I was first in practice, the opioid problem was kind of an inner city problem, and suburban kids might go into the inner city to get the drugs, but the problem's now moved into the suburban communities, and there's very, very sophisticated marketing techniques and delivery techniques and smuggling techniques that have just absolutely flooded the area with very, very inexpensive heroin, which is obviously highly addictive. But what a lot of people don't know is that the prescribed opioids are even more addictive. And that, upwards of 80% of people who take opioids for more than several weeks develop withdrawal symptoms, and many of them become fully addicted. Mm-hmm. So it's a sneaky kind of problem. Mm-hmm. And, there's many paths to addiction. What we offer as a company are new facilities in the Midwest that are offering both inpatient and outpatient programs that are community-based. People don't have to go away to Florida or to California and then come back and try and figure out what to do. They can get treatment close to home. Family can be involved in the treatment, and it works much, much better than when you go away on a vacation in a sunny place and then come back to the reality of home. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people wind up in relapse. But let me talk a little bit about my early experience with treating addicted people.
Yes.
I'm a family physician, and part of my residency, I did a two-week rotation in Camden, New Jersey, which is one of the poor suburbs of the Philadelphia area, and it was primarily alcohol in that facility, and you know, it's an inpatient facility, and as you know, alcohol withdrawal can be life-threatening. It can be an extremely dangerous thing, and this is still a problem in our community as a whole. And I think the bigger problem with alcohol is that it's legal, and people are just focused on, oh, I'll try not to drink too much, and they keep trying to switch things around a little bit. You know, the old W.C. Fields, it's easy to quit drinking. I've done it 1,000 times.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The problem is the cravings that people get, both with alcohol and with opiates afterwards. And so inpatient, you know, people with alcohol, people with Xanax problems is very, very important. And so anyway, in my training, I did 2 weeks and in this inner city detox area of West Jersey Hospital. And it was just really fascinating to see the honesty in these people talking about their problems, and, you know, it just touched me emotionally. And then I went into private practice and got very, very busy with your garden variety primary care kind of issues, and periodically I would see alcoholics and I would struggle to find facilities that would be able to take them, because shortly afterwards West Jersey shut down their detox unit.
Mm-hmm.
And then as time went on, I got very involved in smoking cessation, which, as you know, is our number one drug problem, kills way more people than anything else. But once again, it's a legal drug, and, you know, it's taking out people much later in life, so it grabs less headlines. But, you know, we've made a lot of progress with smoking cessation. I started going to ASAM programs, the American Society of Addiction Medicine, and started learning more about opiate treatment. And I added on buprenorphine or Suboxone to my armamentarium of medications to help people out with addictions, and really saw great results with it. Really seen a lot of people who, you know, the people who take it the way they're supposed to and have a decent social support network, they can do extremely well with Suboxone. But Suboxone all by itself really doesn't fix the problem. It helps people to feel better so they can start doing other recovery activities. And so I was doing that for a few years, and then I got approached by the people at Pinnacle Treatment Centers about helping them out with developing their program at Endeavor House. They had just purchased Endeavor House from the previous owner, and so I got to learn the inpatient side of things. And what we do in residential programs is take people out of the toxic home environment, out of the environment that they're using in, carefully bring them off the poisonous medications. And the new term we talk about is withdrawal symptom management. And so we use small doses of buprenorphine, and our primary emphasis is for these people, especially if their life is in a lot of turmoil. You know, their parents have thrown them out of their house, they're unemployed, they're homeless, you know, they're looking for a whole fresh start, a new place to live afterwards, that these folks can be a really, really good candidate for the Vivitrol shot, for naltrexone injection. And the nice thing about these Vivitrol shots is they're just once a month, so they don't depend on the person to take a medication every day to help control their craving. And so this is something that you need to be off of the opioids for a full 10 days. You know, you have to be off of heroin, off of Suboxone, off of everything for at least 10 days before you get the shot. And our residential programs are a ideal place to get that 10 days of opiate-free, where out in the community it's very, very hard for somebody who's actively addicted to deal with the withdrawals and to be off of everything continuously.
I can imagine that, you say the residential program does help out. It probably helps out the best, I suppose, in this particular case. As you say, you get someone who's realized the problems or have overcome them, and they're doing their best to try to wean themselves off the drug, I suppose. If we may, let's go back briefly here just to the alcohol issue. Still with us, obviously, as you've mentioned. when you talk about what you've experienced as an internist and what you've learned in your family medicine practice as well about alcohol problems, do those problems sometimes, and people trying to wean themselves off alcohol, does that sometimes lead to going to maybe not knowing it, to harder drugs, even if it's just to barbiturates or something like that at first, and then, of course, it escalates into something a lot harder?
Yeah, the pattern I see more often with people with heroin problems, I hear about them, back in my early days, I had a serious drinking problem, and I was able to stop.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had an operation, and I started taking these pain pills, and I really, really liked them, and I haven't touched a drink since because I like the feeling of the opioid a lot better.
Yeah, and now I'm hooked on heavier stuff now, right?
Right, yeah. And, you know, obviously the alcohol, for somebody who's really hooked on alcohol, the withdrawal can be extremely dangerous. There's up to a 10% mortality rate from alcohol detox. But the overall withdrawal thing is a lot shorter than with the opioids. And this is a problem we have in the treatment community, is that the rehabs were all set up originally for the alcohol problem. And opioid addiction is a very, very, very different beast. So it's much, much more focused on a single circuit in the brain. And addiction isn't bad behavior, bad choices. It's a problem with the brain. There's circuits in the brain that just get hijacked by these very, very powerful drugs. And that's prescription drugs as well as the heroin. Mm-hmm. And the circuits stop working right. And it becomes not so much trying to relieve stress or just wanting to feel good. It's just trying to avoid withdrawal, just trying to be functional. And the people who wind up in addiction, they wake up every single morning in horrible withdrawals. And you know, the drunk driving problem is after people use. The impaired driving from opioids is trying to go get something in the morning when they're in full-blown withdrawal. That's when they're most impaired, not when they're sitting at home or, you know, after they use. After they use, they become energized, functional. They're okay for a while. The problem is it starts taking more and more and more.
Right.
And, you know, people go from sniffing or swallowing the prescription medicines to injecting other things, and that's where the most horrible infectious diseases and other side effects come up, you know. And the other part of with addiction is people see all these problems happening and they don't necessarily relate it to the drug or to the alcohol. So they're looking at the policeman who arrested him, what a mean person he was, whereas really the problem was they were doing drugs. They were doing stuff as a result of their addiction, but they tend to focus on something else or other people, you know. If you had my wife, you'd be drinking too, or, you know, there's all kinds of excuses. And the other problem is people don't see a way out. And this is something I really, really want to emphasize, is that we have medications that help, and we have recovery programs that many, many paths to recovery. So the treatment isn't just don't use and go to meetings. You know, 12-step meetings are a vital part of the whole recovery process, but there's a lot of steps in between where we get people to, through taking little steps at a time, to get involved in developing a network of support, finding a safe place to live where they're avoiding triggers, and learn new coping skills. So people focus on, well, if I just stop using, I'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is they stop using and their brain is extremely, extremely abnormal. These circuits are not working right, and it takes a lot of time. With heroin, can take up to 18 months for the brain to actually normalize with treatment.
Wow.
And we see this on brain scans. So, yeah, this is a normal brain. This is your brain on drugs. This is your brain 18 months later, and it's just starting to get normalized. So these 30 days, you know, away in Florida in the sunshine, come back home and you're cured, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that really, really doesn't work. And what's needed is long-term treatment in the community. And if people come to one of our residential programs, and don't do anything after they leave that's helpful for their recovery, then it really doesn't work well. And one of the things I'm most excited about our Merivale Recovery Works program is that we already have a very sizable community-based intensive outpatient program where people come 3 days a week for 3 hours at a time, and they work through all the issues that they have to work through immediately being released, you know, immediately after being released from a residential program. So we have this continuity where we have the same counselors and they're coming back to the same facility. You know, it's a different focus of the groups and of the individual therapy as well. And it's more about how do I stay stopped, you know, because it is so easy to quit.
That's,
but, you know, the problem is staying stopped, learning new coping skills, and you know, getting back on track with employment and family responsibility.
Dr. Johnson, let's take a few moments here and talk here with the little time we've got left here about the problem we have heard lately here about fentanyl. That's become extremely dangerous, I understand. And obviously you and your colleagues there at the Pinnacle Treatment Centers, in particular the Recovery Works facility here in Northwest Indiana, see that. How does that tell us about how that problem gets in the way of trying to get somebody off drugs in particular and get their life straightened out?
Yeah, well, if they're dead, we can't help them. This is the problem.
That's true. It seems to be the case that it's so dangerous that it will kill somebody first, I suppose, won't it?
Yeah, the EMTs say they know when it's fentanyl because, you know, the tourniquet's off, but the needle's still in the arm.
Yeah.
You know, it's just an immediate thing. And the problem is, you know, if they're getting bags and it's powder and it's mixed in, then it clumps up. So they have a bunch of very weak doses, and then all of a sudden there's the killer dose.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, if they're... The other thing a lot of people don't realize is at least two-thirds of overdose deaths are associated with either Xanax, Valium, Klonopin, or alcohol. So people are trying to supplement the effects of the opioids with sedatives, and it's a very, very increasingly lethal combination. So it's not just the fentanyl, it's the other stuff they do with it.
Well, Dr. Johnson, we're unfortunately out of time, and we're going to have to come back together for another conversation to be up to date on things as well, too. And we appreciate you spending some time with us today to talk about this. We've been talking with Dr. Chris Johnson. He is the National Medical Director for the Pinnacle Treatment Centers across the East Coast and the Midwest as well. And they have the Recovery Works residential facility. They've just started up in Merivale. And Dr. Johnson, thank you very much for spending some time explaining the problem and how folks that have the problem with addictions of all sorts. It's obviously not just opioids and drugs, but it's also alcohol as well, too. They need to get the help that they right away, as soon as they can, to try to get their lives straightened back up again. Thank you very much for spending some time to talk with us about it today.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. And treatment really works, and we can really help a lot of people when they're ready to stop and when family are willing to assist them to get into our program. Thank you.
The new governor, Eric Holcomb, promised in his State of the State address to make it easier for counties to establish syringe exchange programs. And a bill that is moving through the General Assembly would make that possible. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Becca Costello reports that the programs that are aimed at reducing the spread of HIV and hepatitis C, though, still face significant opposition.
Hepatitis C cases in Tippecanoe County increased about 30% each year for the past 3 years. Health officials have been working on a syringe exchange proposal for more than a year. County commissioners approved the plan last November, and the state health department approved the plan a month later. But Tippecanoe County Public Health Nursing Supervisor Kayla Hostetler says the program won't be ready to open for at least another few months.
There's a lot of different parts, and trying to make sure all those parts were met to have the state approval for the syringe exchange program was a daunting task for and some people. We're kind of scared of that process here.
An unprecedented outbreak of HIV cases in Scott County 2 years ago marked a change in how state officials addressed the state's drug epidemic. People were sharing dirty needles to shoot up powerful prescription painkillers. Then Governor Mike Pence approved a bill that allowed counties to establish programs where intravenous drug users could turn and use needles for clean ones. But counties have to get state approval before they start an exchange. Governor Eric Holcomb wants to change that, and he included that goal as one of his top priorities in his first State of the State address.
We have heroes on the front lines saving lives every day. They include the public health nurses who run syringe exchange programs in 9 Indiana counties. And that's why we will give county officials authority to establish syringe exchange programs to ensure that the people making the decisions are those closest to the problem.
House Bill 1438, authored by Republican Cindy Kirchhofer, eliminates the step that requires state approval. It has bipartisan support, but does face significant opposition from new Republican Attorney General Curtis Hill, who testified against the bill at a House committee hearing.
The reality is that these exchange programs have actually morphed into a distribution program where the exchange is not necessary in order to get the needles. What ends up happening is you get a net increase in the number of needles, and that net increase in the number of needles can provide a greater risk of exposure and expansion of the infectious diseases that we're trying to prevent.
But the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that's not true. In fact, it encourages the expansion of the programs nationwide. Dr. Carrie Lawrence is the director of Project Cultivate at the Rural Center for AIDS and STD Prevention.
It seemed like he wasn't really aware of the research and evidence that's out there that is not true. In fact, it reduces the harms associated with injection drug use.
But Attorney General Curtis Hill isn't alone in his concerns. Back in Tippecanoe County, Hostetler says progress is slow because of local opposition.
A lot of people don't understand exactly what a syringe exchange program is. They just think it's giving people needles and then you're condoning drug use.
But Hostetler says the programs offer a lot more than that. Overdose intervention drugs, health insurance help, referrals to addiction and mental health counselors, help with transportation, food, immunizations, and vaccines. The programs will offer STD testing and condoms, and all of that is free for participants. Those costs add up quickly, and state law prohibits any state funding for the programs. Amanda Balser is the grant financial supervisor for Tippecanoe County's syringe exchange proposal. She says securing funds from private donations and grants is the biggest reason there's not already a syringe exchange in Tippecanoe County.
It's been almost all funding. We already had our plan in place. We already knew what we wanted. The state approved our plan immediately. We never had to go back and forth on that. So everything has been funding.
But state funding isn't being addressed this legislative session. Before the election, Holcomb expressed tentative support for funding syringe exchanges through the state. But he now defers to a new statewide position he created, the Executive Director for Drug Prevention, Treatment, and Enforcement, Jim McClelland. McClelland fully supports the proposal to give county officials authority to establish a needle exchange, but has not announced his position on state funding. Dr. Lawrence says she wants to see a lot more progress, but
this bill initially has moved in the right direction, and I think Governor Holcomb was very brave in his willingness to even state this needs to be brought down to a local level.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Becca Costello.
A national report recently gave Indiana a failing grade for reproductive rights. It measures reproductive health subjects, including access to contraception, to insurance coverage, and abortion restrictions. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports that the state received a 0 score when it comes to prevention, including sexual education.
The Population Institute prepared the report on reproductive health, and it wasn't all bad news. Indiana's teen pregnancy rate is down, so are the number of abortions, and most adult women are able to access contraception and care. But in one area, the state received a 0, prevention. Half of all pregnancies in Indiana are unintended, and preventing unwanted pregnancies often starts with education.
We're going to go this way.
At Lebanon High School in North Central Indiana, Ryan Tucker has been teaching health for over 10 years.
You hear the phrase, knowledge is power, you know, information is power, so why not give them as much as we can, you know, and hope that they can make more responsible, mature decisions.
According to the most recent Youth Risk Assessment Survey, 41% of Indiana teens are sexually active, but under current state standards, Tucker is not allowed to teach about contraception.
we're not allowed to design a lesson plan necessarily to talk about safe sex practices, but students are allowed to ask me questions and I can give appropriate information for those questions.
The federal government currently supports this type of sexual education curriculum and gives money to states that teach abstinence, more commonly referred to now as sexual risk avoidance. Schools in Indiana are required to teach this curriculum and stay away from topics like safe sex and sexually transmitted diseases, except for HIV. There is a bill in session to change this. Republican State Senator Jean Lysing says it's time for an update.
Our Department of Ed has not revised health curriculum academic standards since 2010. And for me, that seems like light years ago in the way our society and world has changed.
A bill filed this session aims for a more comprehensive health education program that would be more frank about preventing pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases. Lysing thinks young adults should have access to this information.
It's wrong for us, when we have that medical data, not to share it with those young people and still express certainly a conservative view on all this stuff.
Indiana school districts often supplement their sex education with help from nonprofits that teach teens to avoid sexual activity by suggesting they wait. Creating Positive Relationships is one of those organizations that visits high schools in Indiana. Director Karen Mitchell says teen pregnancy is nothing new.
You know, 100 years ago, they were talking about this, and still, you know, it is a girl is less likely to graduate from high school, more likely to live in poverty. I mean, we still haven't figured out what to do with that.
Their program aims to give young people tools to have healthy relationships without sex.
Studies have shown, too, that schools that even pass out condoms, they see a higher percentage of kids that are sexually active.
Studies are actually conflicting on this issue, but there is some evidence that safer sex programs help to reduce sexually transmitted disease and teen pregnancy. Healthcare Education and Training Executive Director Abby Hunt works to promote reproductive health in Indiana. She says there are things that teens need to know about safe sex.
They need to know that if they decide to become sexually active, how to not become pregnant or cause a pregnancy. So they need to know about contraception. They need to know how to access that.
Hunt says common ground about sexual education can be achieved.
And you're willing to listen and have an open conversation about this work. Usually you can find a place where everybody agrees.
Senator Lysing hopes everyone can agree the state needs updated health standards and says her proposal is simple.
My whole thing is to try to keep them healthy, healthy for the rest of their life.
Lysing's bill has not had a hearing in the Senate. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
Speaking. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. State Senator Eddie Melton's 2017 session legislative priorities survey results are back in his latest email newsletter. It begins with, "We asked, you answered." And before the start of the session, Eddie Melton had asked for his constituents' thoughts on a number of the Senate Democrats' legislative proposals and tallying up the responses. They have the results to share today, and here's what came about in Eddie Melton's legislative priorities survey. To the question, do you support or oppose a statewide expansion of the state's pre-kindergarten program? 83% of those who responded to the survey support it, 16% oppose. And number two question, rather than legislators drawing their own district boundaries, do you support or oppose the establishment of an independent, nonpartisan redistricting committee? 82% of Senator Melton's constituents support it, 15% oppose. Do you support or oppose raising the minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to $10.10 an hour? 84% of Eddie Melton's constituents support it, 15% oppose it. On another question, do you support or oppose legislation to increase voter access, including more early voting options and expanded poll hours? 81% of the respondents to the poll support it, 17% oppose. 84% of those who responded to the question, do you support or oppose policies to provide paid leave to care for a sick family member or your child? They support the measure, and 14% oppose it. And finally, do you support or oppose amending the state's civil rights statute to include protections for the LGBT community? 71% of Senator Eddie Melton's constituents who responded to his request for their comments support the idea. 26% oppose it. 3%, by the way, did not answer it. And by the way, we'll have other survey results from some of the other Northwest Indiana lawmakers through Regionally Speaking this week. Proposed legislation that defines student prayer and religious protections in public schools passed out of committee this morning. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle tells us, the legislation puts limits on some beliefs.
Supporters of House Bill 1024 say the intent is to provide guidelines on how and when students may express their religion or lead a prayer in class. It also allows principals to prohibit expression of religion if it's contrary to citizenship or moral instruction. Democrat Representative Vernon Smith of Gary supports the bill and says religious limits are needed.
There's a lot of crazy stuff out there now, and we need to try to make sure that that doesn't enter into our schools as well.
But Democrat Representative Ed Delaney of Indianapolis says he's seen no evidence that prayer is constrained in schools. If this becomes law, he says, students of all religions will wind up offended and possibly suing the state.
You destroy prayer by having the state behind it. And that's what this bill does.
The proposal passed the House Education Committee 10-2 Tuesday and now heads to the full House. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Weddle in Indianapolis.
Hundreds of Hoosiers gathered at the State House on Monday to support a bill that would preserve 10% of state forests as old growth, where the state cannot harvest trees for logging. Senate Bill 420 isn't new legislation. Groups like the Indiana Forest Alliance have advocated for years for a law that requires some of the state's forests be preserved from logging. But so far, none of the bills have made it out of committee. The IFA points to a large increase in logging over the last decade in Indiana, saying that it is not sustainable. An Indiana Forest Alliance director of communications, Ann Laker, says that this session's legislation isn't asking for much.
So this year, we decided to encourage the introduction of a bill that was more moderate and could have been more popular among the supermajority that we have right now, setting aside 10% of state forests.
State Forester John Seifer says the only motivation for logging is the health of the state forests.
All we do is manage. This is like think of a garden. You're thinning, you're reproducing, you try to create a habitat to keep everything going.
The deadline for legislation to advance out of committee is later today. An event which is being called the Big Dream Gathering is coming to Valparaiso University on Tuesday, February 28th. It'll begin about 6 o'clock or so in the evening, and it'll happen at the Hari Union Building on the VU campus. It is the dream, literally, of a man named Mitch Matthews. In fact, we are talking now with Mitch to tell us more about his dream and what the Big Dream Gathering is all about and what folks attending at the Valparaiso University campus will see later this month. Mitch, thanks for joining us here in Ridgely Speaking.
Well, thanks so much, Chris. I appreciate it.
Give us an idea of what was going through your mind when you created that very first Big Dream Gathering that I guess kind of got a mushroomed, I understand, from what you had planned there in West Des Moines, Iowa.
Exactly right. Yeah, it definitely was not our plan to do something like this. I was actually acting out of complete and total desperation, Chris. back in 2006, my wife and I were working on a business kind of dream of ours. I was actually working to create a game series, and everything had been going great leading up to that time. But then over a period of about a month, everything kind of quickly fell apart. We had a manufacturer that all of a sudden was having all sorts of problems. We had a designer who had helped us design the game, and her computer crashed, and she lost files, 6 months worth of files. And then the big one was we started to run out of money, which you've probably never had that experience, but that was horrifying for me. And all of a sudden, our dream was on the ropes, and I wanted to quit. I wanted to give up, and I sat in my office on a Saturday morning contemplating that, trying to get out, and I realized, wait, I need some help. This is my dream, and I need some help. And then I thought, well, maybe some of our friends could help us, and then I had a very convicting thought. And realizing, you know, I don't know what my friends' dreams are. Like, you know, I might ask them to help me with theirs or with mine, but I didn't know what theirs were. So I thought, well, what if we invited some friends to our house? We all had everybody write down some of their dreams and goals on sheets of paper. We put them on the walls of our living room and just see if we could help each other out. Look at each other's dreams, write notes to each other, you know, some encouragement, some ideas, some offers to help. And so we did that, and it was initially just to save our dream, but it, like you said, it kind of blossomed, and it was only supposed to go for a couple of hours on a Tuesday night. We lost control of it, and that first one went for a full week. We knew everybody that was there for that first night, but then those people brought people, and then within a couple of nights, strangers were showing up at our house. And what was amazing is we got to see it play out, in that some people came and they knew exactly what they were going to write down, but other people needed to come and just see each other's dreams to be inspired to say, well, what are my dreams? I don't even know what my dreams are, but by seeing someone else's dreams or by talking with someone about their dreams, it opened up all sorts of possibilities. And our dream got back on track. A bunch of other dreams got launched because of that first big dream gathering. So we just decided to keep them going, and now we do them all over the country, and we're bringing it to your area on Tuesday.
Did the folks at Valparaiso University, students on campus or organizations, ask you to come to campus to talk about what your experiences were in creating this this big dream idea?
Yeah, absolutely. We've been working with students and faculty there. They've been fantastic. They heard about the Big Dream Gathering story. They saw me speak at a conference and said, please, can we bring it to the school? And we've got a national sponsor now, American Family Insurance, which has really helped because now we can make these events free to attend. The first 100 people that come actually get a free copy of my book, all of that. But it's truly just to get people in a room so that they give themselves permission to dream and then help each other out. That's really at the core of it, is just letting people be in that encouraging environment where they can think about their dreams and then potentially make a connection or be able to help with somebody else's dream while they're there.
Mitch, give us an example, if you will, of an idea, of someone's idea, a dream, if you will, that posted it on the walls there at your place or maybe in some other event, and they were able to work it out and actually turn it into something.
Absolutely. I mean, we've had all sorts of dreams happen. We've had people get clear on wanting to launch businesses or nonprofits. We've had people get clear that they wanted to take trips and made those happen. But I think some of my favorites are, some of the simpler dreams, or just where maybe even two people that, were friends all of a sudden realized they had a shared dream. We had, as an example of that, we had two college students that were friends, lifelong friends, that came to a Big Dream Gathering together. And, they participated, they started to write their dreams down. And then afterwards, they started to talk about, well, what did you put up? And what did you put up? And they both realized they wanted to write a book. And what was neat was they were like, well, maybe we should do it together. And so they did that. They actually started to think about, what can we write a book on now? And they wrote it together, and they actually took it to Amazon and sold it on Amazon and sold about $7,000 worth of books in the first month it launched. And they were college students.
Wow.
So, it's one of those things that, here they were lifelong friends, but they'd never talked about their dreams together. But then they were able to walk together to actually make that happen. And they've been able to write books since. And it's pretty exciting to see. And that's what we see is so often. It's just that, the power of somebody giving themselves permission to dream and in some cases dream again.
Let me ask you, Mitch, you have a chance when you do these big dream gatherings to see all kinds of people there. Would you say that millennials or maybe even Gen Xers seem to be the ones that they come in with the most ideas about dreams and wanting to find a way to put them into reality?
It's a great question. I'm kind of a geek, so I love to study out generations and kind of the differences between generations. And you would almost think that millennials would come in fired up with a list of 100 dreams already clarified. But in many cases, especially in this, in this environment, students, often millennials, will come up and tell me afterwards, like, they'll say, this is the first time I've actually thought about my own dreams. And I've had other people tell me what my dreams should be. I've had people suggest what I should set up as goals for my life. But this is the first time where I've really allowed myself to just get clear for myself. And I think that's something that's exciting. And it's been eye-opening for me. I kind of thought, well, we started doing it on college campuses about 6 years ago. And I kind of thought, well, college students, they're big dreamers. They're going to know what their dreams are. It's going to be easy for them. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes, they're scratching their heads, when they first arrive as well, going, I don't really know what my dreams are. But through the course of the evening, through hearing more stories, hearing some strategies to kind of help people get that clarity, I do a little keynote on the front end to help people kind of prime the pump a little bit. So then the dreams start coming, whether it's millennials, Gen Xers, boomers, and we do have a wide variety of people come, especially, thanks to people like you getting the word out. And the more diverse the room, the better.
And we're talking here not only dreams that are not only ones maybe that will end up, as with your case, in business, but also just dreams that may change somebody's life or even change somebody's career. Because obviously that's a good place to have such a gathering is at a university where you have people that haven't quite formed what they want to do with their lives, whether it's a work life or a personal life.
Absolutely. Well, and it's funny. We recently had a big dream gathering. A woman came up and she said, "Hi, I'm Tammy, and I'm 45 years old."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well, wow, Tammy, it's nice to meet you." And I said, "Most people don't introduce themselves that way." She said, "Well, I just wanted to let you know."
I suppose you probably aren't looking at people that are baby boomers. You know, you don't get many baby boomers at these things. Yeah,
exactly. Well, she was interesting because she said, "I tell you that I'm 45 because as you were speaking, I realized it's been at least 20 years since I gave myself permission to dream." And I said, "Oh, wow." She said, "It's not like I haven't accomplished things." She said, "I just haven't given myself that permission to dream." And she said, "While you were talking, I realized, I've got a dream for a vacation. And it's a different kind of vacation. It's just being able to get away with my family. And, lots is going on. And I just realized I've always wanted to just take them to a beach and just get away for a week. And not some crazy thing, but just something simple." And she said, that's not a, changing the world kind of thing. It's just kind of a little bit of changing my world. And she said, "Thanks for that." And it's great. She let me know probably about 9 months later that she'd gotten the vacation scheduled, and a year later they'd gotten the vacation accomplished. And, she didn't start a nonprofit. She didn't write a best-selling book, but she changed her world just a little bit by giving herself permission to dream. And I love stories like that.
Well, there's all kinds of things that can happen during a big dream gathering like this one. The one coming up at Valparaiso University is going to be on Tuesday, February 28th, starting about 6:15 in the evening. It'll be held in the Hara Union building there on the VU campus. And the idea for the gathering in general coming as the inspiration from ideas from Mitch Matthews, who's been with us to talk about these gatherings. Mitch, thanks very much. Hope you have a great time at Valparaiso University and enjoy the folks that are going to be at the event coming up later in the month, as well as ones that come in the future. And thank you for talking about it today.
Oh, thanks so much, Chris. I really appreciate it.
Kyle Meredith talks with Noel Skaggs of Fits in the Tantrums on this edition today of The Speed of Sound.
The Speed of Sound with Kyle Meredith.
Fits in the Tantrums may have arrived as a pop throwback for the next generation, but they didn't stay in that box for long. They were quick to move into 80s sound experiments with 2013's More Than Just a Dream and a present sound all their own in last year's self-titled effort. That direction progression was accompanied by lifestyle and location changes for the band members too, which is where my conversation starts with co-founder Noel Skaggs. I'm Kyle Meredith at The Speed of Sound.
It's complicated.
Did I read that you, are you living in Nashville now?
I am living here in Nashville. I moved here a year and a half ago, actually.
From L.A.?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a big change?
You know what? It is. I mean, it is and it isn't. I had friends when I came here, so it made it a lot easier for the transition. And it just kind of seemed like I was supposed to be here. Like, my house fell in my lap about 10 days after I started looking. It's been really fun. I think I was fortunate enough to have really good friends that lived here, and, it made it easier to meet more people. But Nashville is just so laid back. It's really, really easy to kind of find your footing really quickly.
Can I get a witness in the darkness? Because there ain't no love at all to be found. Feeling like a freight train, trying to break chains. Everybody needs somebody, no doubt.
I can't imagine you have too much free time on your hands outside of Fits, but do you get the chance to do like extra session work or guest work with people down there?
Yeah, you know what? I try to do more like writing sessions with different people. It's been interesting because it's funny enough, a lot of the stuff that I've been doing has been working more with overseas artists. I don't know, they've been calling me more recently. But yeah, it's just like getting in with friends that have been writing. It's been a really cool experience just kind of learning a different technique as well. Because a lot of the songwriters that I do know are very influenced and driven in writing country music, but they also do a lot of pop as well. So I've learned a lot of little tricks from them and just storytelling that, I'm now implementing into my new work.
I can see you better than your demons at night. You're so restless.
Now, how does that work with the long-distance relationship with Fitz and the band?
I think it's pretty easy now. At this point, we've been together for so long that we don't have to live in the same city in order to, you know, create with each other. It's a lot easier, I think, now just sending ideas over. Our focus at this point has just really been on this new record and, you know, trying to expand the listener and the audience to what we've done, not just historically, but what we're doing now as well. You know, it's been this really cool kind of, like, I would say, growing stage for us. I don't think we were sure exactly how it was going to work when I moved, because it's like me and Fitz being together, but it worked out pretty well. You know, we had to do the majority of this new record that way, because I moved right in the middle of the process. We've always pushed each other to do more, to see where we can take our sound and, you know, where we could more experiment and grow. This time around, I think we decided we needed to take a break, you know, like we had given ourselves a moment to really breathe. We had gone from one record to the next, the touring, you know, for almost 2.5 years after that, and we just got burned, you know. And people wanted to focus on families and buying homes and having babies and doing all of these different things. You know, so when it came around the time that we were going to start working on this record, I think Fitz and I were kind of both looked at each other like, wow, what are we going to talk about next? And what we found is that we kind of hit a point of writer's block creatively. Like, we couldn't figure out what moved us, you know. So it got to the point where, you know, it was kind of like an ego check, you know. It's not going to be as easy as it was on the last record or, you know, even the record prior. This is going to take a lot of work, and we got to decide what we're going to sing about. Oh, if your heart starts beating, oh. You know, I ended up coming to Nashville and just basically, you know, wrote on my own here, sent ideas, Fitz did the same. You know, one day I get a phone call from Fitz. He's like, I'm sending you this track you just wrote, and I want to see what you think about it. The lyrics weren't completely there and stuff, so he sent it over, and it was hand clap. Somebody save your soul, because you've been sinning in the city. I know too many troubles, all these lovers kept you losing control. And I was like, oh, this is, you know, this is really cool. This is really different, you know. It was really different for us, me thinking more in the way of always kind of trying to figure out if we're not, you know, stepping out of ourselves where we could never go back, because you're going too forward, you know, people got to get it. And that was the first thing that had hit me, was like, oh, is this really us, and what are we doing here? And then when I finally got my hands on it, you know, started tinkering with the ideas, and then I went to LA and recorded the vocals on the track, and it was just this natural thing that happened. Everything flowed from there. I can make your hands clap. Said I can make your hands clap. Every night when the stars come out. I think, you know, had it not been for the, you know, kind of separation and allowing ourselves the time and, you know, checking the egos at the door and saying, hey, we may need some help with this, I don't think we would have gotten the record done. You know, I think we'd still be writing it.
The latest from Fitz and the Tantrums is the self-titled disc that came out just last year. And thanks to Noelle Skaggs for discussing it with us. For more of my interviews, head to Facebook and Twitter at Kyle Meredith. And thanks to Brad Yost for co-producing and editing this episode. From the studios of WFPK in Louisville, Kentucky, I'm Kyle Meredith at The Speed of Sound.
Speed of Sound can be heard Tuesdays and Thursdays here on Regionally Speaking. Also found on our new website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. Just go on the homepage to the Programs tab and click on Programs A through Z. You'll find Speed of Sound there. And reminder, too, by the way, season number 2 of Speed of Sound will end next week. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us on tomorrow's program. Conversation with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. Hope you'll join us for that.